the future.
There are no people.
There are no people in the future.
No people at all.
There are no people in the future.
Where did all my people go?
There are no people in the future.
Let me try my people call.
Everybody, welcome, welcome to Raging Chickens Out to Coop Live. Yes, it is our live show for Monday, May 3rd, 2021. At Out to Coop Live, we talk to progressives, activists, and troublemakers of all sorts, right from our own backyards, from across the country. On Fridays, of course, we've got our news roundup where Sean Kitchen and I break down the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. You can get both by subscribing to our podcast on Podbean, iTunes, Spotify, wherever you get your podcast. You can only be part of the conversation every Monday night at 7 p.m. Eastern. You don't want to remind everybody, if you're not already over on our live stream on YouTube, if you're still looking to get there, make sure that those folks you're on right now, make sure you're subscribing to the show, making sure you're liking the stream. Make sure you hit that little notification bell so you know every time that we go live. That's how we kind of make sure that we get this full-on signal boost and get our messages out. You can help support this show by becoming a patron. For as little as $5 a month, just go to patreon.com/rcpress. And if you're listening to this show live, oh, God, you know what you can do is make sure you share it out to all your friends right now. Let us know that you're listening. For more PA Progressive Talk, you can tune in to Rick Smith Show's live stream at 9 p.m. Eastern on his YouTube channel, Twitter, Facebook, and subscribe to his podcast wherever you get your podcast. Just go to ricksmithshow.com for all his latest across all the platforms. And you must check out the newly launched Sisters of the Night Caucus podcast. You can find it on Anchor, Spotify, iTunes, wherever you get your podcast. The amazing PA women stirring the political cauldron behind this podcast rock the house, and they know where the bodies are buried. Spooky, right? So make sure to give them a follow on at the Night Caucus. That's at the Night Caucus on Twitter. And attention gamers, the Game Inn. That's Game Inn with two N's. The Game Inn is a Quakertown-based black family-owned gaming store. They're friends of the show. Actually, the family of one of my son's best friends. That's why we get the shout out right here on this show. And they've got everything from retro N64s, the latest consoles, video games for all platforms, loads of collectibles, action figures, Funko Pops, and kids get a discount with every A at the report card. Check them out on their Facebook page. Follow them on Twitter at TheGameIn. Got a question about a game? Look for something hard to get. Shoot them a message. Drop them an email at TheGameInPA@gmail.com. Check out all their stuff at TheGameIn.com. And a special shout out once again to Jonathan Mann. That's Mann with two N's. We're in the two N's scope right here, who wrote our intro song, There Are No People in the Future. Check out all his great stuff on his YouTube page and follow him on Twitter at SongOfDayMan. That's with two N's, at SongOfDayMan on Twitter. Well, I've been looking forward to this show now for a while. So on tonight's show, I welcome to the show Joshua Boaz Probanek. Did I get that right, Probanek?
Yep, that's right, Probanek.
Hey, how about that?
Nailed it. Question from Pennsylvania.
Yeah, exactly. He is a co-creator and co-director of the Rights of Nature documentary, The Invisible Hand. Invisible Hand has been called a paradigm-shifting documentary about the struggle for the recognition of the rights of nature, quite possibly a defining battle of our times where nature, democracy face off in rural America. Produced by award-winning actor Mark Ruffalo, Invisible Hand takes us behind the curtain of the global economy where rights of nature becomes capitalism's primary opponent. The film's epic battle does not begin in the centers of global capital, but in the small rural community of Grant Township, PA, as residents band together to stop a fracking waste injection well from being located in their town. The rights of nature may be the most provocative and powerful assemblages of Western legal traditions and indigenous knowledge this country has ever seen. And it may be what is necessary to combat the climate crisis and reimagine global civilization. Joshua is a film director, editor, investigative reporter who has gained international attention for his reporting on fracking shale gas in the United States. He's probably best known for his award-winning documentary films on fracking, the 2013 film Triple Divide and the 2017 film Triple Divide Redacted. And now, of course, we got Invisible Hand. Joshua is also the co-founder of the investigative journalism nonprofit Public Herald, where he serves as editor-in-chief. Public Herald has been cited in over 200 publications, including The New Yorker, Mother Jones, Rolling Stone, and The New York Times. Joshua, welcome to the show.
Kevin, Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, man, I can't tell you. Well, no, I should say, should give a shout out for people who are wondering. Say, originally, Joshua's co-creator, co-director, Melissa Troutman, was going to join us tonight, but something came up shortly before the show. She wasn't able to make it. We're certainly going to be checking with her, and we have her on as soon as that kind of comes on in the future. Let me say this before we even get started in this. I freaking love this film. Okay. I have talked about it like probably just about every week that we've been touching upon issues about fracking or the climate crisis. It's like, not only do I think that this film raises the bar over kind of the kind of issues and the kinds of frameworks that we need to be thinking about as we move forward for even like a post-climate crisis civilization, right? But also, it's just beautiful. I mean, you know, so I just thank you for that alone.
Well, thank you for sharing that. It means a lot. And, you know, after 6 years of production for it, that's a great response to get. So I appreciate that.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Well, and deserved every word of it, too, as well. So, like I said, I gave us, you know, a little bit of a, you know, intro to that. The biggest struggle lead up to today to kind of introducing this film and introducing you was, you know, like not including everything, right? Because there's so much you could say about here. Well, let me just kind of, well, before we get into the film itself, maybe you kind of take us back a little bit to, say, the genesis of this project. Because I know that this wasn't something to just, you know, oh, it kind of popped up in that, you know, so you decided in a week you're going to make a film. But take us through a little about that journey, that what gets us to this kind of Rights of Nature, the documentary, and then eventually what we see here in Grand Township.
Yeah. Like, it's different for most folks, you know, the way that they get introduced to Rights of Nature. For me, it was struggling in college with these ideas that they had with environmental science, or ideas that they had in philosophy or English literature or, you know, biology, about how they were going to protect the environment, how we're going to have a successful economy, and all these kinds of things. And, you know, when you're in college, they tell you things like, you know, Marxism is utopia and blah, blah, blah. But they don't really talk about how capitalism is a utopia.
Right.
You know, you read the books on capitalism, and you read Milton Friedman and everything that they've done, which I did, and you find out pretty quickly that this is a fantasy. You know, the ideas on human nature, the ideas on profit, and the ideas on invisible hand and what that means. So for me, it was a struggle. It was like, so where do you go from here?
Right.
And I remember reading books by like Daniel Quinn or Chomsky or whoever, that were just questioning the vision of the world. And it led me into this organic realm of Rights of Nature. So I immediately drew up a business plan in Ohio, trying to adapt Rights of Nature into a local food economy, into a publication, and see what could happen. And we had a lot of success. We had a local food economy that was bringing in hundreds of thousands of dollars to 15 local farms that I coordinated. We were building a grocery store. We had our own currency going, farmers markets, organic gardens, community gardens. And on top of that, we had our own publication covering this stuff. So we were doing some really important work. And then all of a sudden fracking came, and it was like, wait a minute. Fracking comes. We just created this certification. One of the things that we were doing was we had a certification which you can use as like an Achilles heel against the free market, because if you have a local grown certification, you know, that kind of thing,
yep.
Free market can never compete with that. No matter what kind of green crap they put on a brand, they can't beat the farm down the road with their own certification. Just can't
right.
do it.
Right.
So we did that to protect, you know, the farmers' premiums from organic pricing and other things like that. And I thought about it. I said, listen, if fracking comes in, you know, we have this kind of Rights of Nature certification, which is what we were working on. We were recreating, you know, county lines, human lines with biological boundaries, with watersheds. How are we going to deal with this? And as I started to look into fracking and looking at how people were dealing with that in Pennsylvania, all of a sudden, within 2 years of starting Public Herald and writing about this issue after I left Ohio, because I just thought, you know, if fracking comes in, it's going to destroy all this. So right. I'm in Pennsylvania looking at it. I see all of a sudden a community in Grant Township's doing Rights of Nature. And I'm thinking,
you're like, what?
Holy shit. What? This is a feasible concept now? And because we weren't even talking about it. We were, it was all like, you know, ninja under the radar
right,
stuff.
Right,
we weren't
right.
talking about rights of nature. All right. This is all like subtext beneath the, you know, we're going to make you money plan. And then I was just blown away, and it just became like, you know, it was so organic where, you know, we had Triple Divide. We just finished that film. People were asking us after the show, what are we supposed to do now? How are we supposed to deal with all these problems? And we were giving them answers, and we thought we could never talk about rights of nature, but here's a community who's going to deal with those problems by passing a rights of nature bill, by enforcing a local law that says nature has personhood and they're not going to allow radioactive waste to be dumped there. And from there, it was just like, turn on the cameras and don't shut them off for 6 years, you know? Yeah.
So then you're talking about a six-year period of time,
yeah,
in which you're tracking this kind of, this is specifically 6 years in Grant Township.
6 years of Grant Township, going back there as much as possible.
Yeah.
You know, filming nature there, filming the Little Mahoning watershed, and then asking these questions abroad. So, you know, going to Standing Rock, asking questions about rights of nature, going to the Ho-Chunk, and I think it was like 2014, asking these questions, or the Blackfeet, or the Seneca Nation, and making sure that, you know, we weren't creating a film that didn't honor kind of where rights of nature is really coming from, which is this sort of indigenous legacy, you know, that has enough of a presence in our Western civilization that rights of nature has a voice, has a language, kind of honoring, you know, that indigenous legacy, and hopefully getting to a place where we can bring those principles back into economy, back into government, back into our way of life.
Well, and that's one of the things I found, and I forget who says it directly in the film, per se, but talks about this merging or this intersection, and a comfortable intersection at times between Western legal traditions, right, and indigenous knowledges, but that kind of emerging in this, you know, in some ways organically, in some ways of like almost like a puzzle. How do we actually translate some of these things into a kind of a legal concept that allows us to assert these rights, you know, that have it, like just exactly as you said, that are ancient, right, in terms of the way that we think about kind of respecting the earth. But of course, Western legal traditions aren't exactly set up to honor those from the beginning. So it's, you're dealing with kind of a whole sets of constructs of private property, about appropriation, and even as the film kind of discusses, like our relationships to, like, Western assumptions about what a relationship is to the planet, right? We've got to have at its core.
When we talk about that, most often we talk about it, you know, in the idea of living within the laws of nature. You know, the Native Americans seem to have a society, a civilization that did live within the laws of nature, did create some kind of balance in this country, and it flourished. I mean, you go back to any of the literature and you read about the life that existed in America from, you know, non-human species, like, you know, fish or animals. It was unreal, the kind of descriptions that happened, you know, with the run of fish on the East Coast, like the salmon that used to run up the rivers on the East Coast of the United States. They don't even exist there anymore.
Yeah, it's like, what? Salmon on the East Coast? What?
Yeah, it's like insane. So, you know, they had like a society that could at least honor these, you know, these things and this way of life through observing and applying the laws of nature within their own governance and within their own language and everything. And we lost all that, right? All we care about is the laws of man. And that's all we give a damn about at this point. So for me, looking at capitalism and thinking about it theoretically, it just seemed like it's impossible that the evolution of capitalism wouldn't come against the rights of nature. For me, it was like rights of nature was always there. You know, this isn't something we're creating. We're just recognizing it as something that exists. And the reason we're getting into it right now is because capitalism has annihilated so much.
Right.
Nature has to defend itself. And we're trying to bring that voice of nature into Western legal society. And this is the way that we're doing it.
Right. And I think, you know, it's like at the very basic level, it's like, you know, the who speaks for the trees, right? It's like,
totally.
I mean, it's like, which is, you know, astounding. So, you know, one thing that you said when you're talking about your kind of evolution and seeing what they're doing in Grant Township, I'm glad you said that, you know, you hadn't been talking about like rights of nature out loud,
right? You know, yeah. I gave a speech on it.
Right.
I gave a speech on it in 2010 at a college, thinking that, you know, we would have a discussion, and professors and people were looking at me like I was talking sci-fi.
Okay, so
and I was just like,
yeah, thank you for saying that.
It was in college, 2010.
Yeah, exactly. And I could imagine that experience, because frankly, you know, when I talked to, you know, Chad Nicholson from CellDef kind of a few weeks back, when kind of looking at this current Grant Township from kind of that angle of things, and of course he's featured in your film too as well.
Yeah, he's a star now. Chad's a star.
Yeah, I asked him what it's like to be a movie star, and he was very uncomfortable with the moniker. So, but
I told him it was coming one way or another.
Yeah, he seemed very uncomfortable. He's like, I reject the title. You know, it's like, but
star, that's just superstar.
Well, yeah, and I just, you know, I think that was my initial sense when I was first seeing this rights of nature thing. I was like, all going through my mind was like, this is the kind of thing, if you went up to somebody and you said, yeah, we're looking for the rights of nature, that they're going to look at you as some absolute nut job, right? That you're kind of off on some sort of lunatic fringe. But it's really not that big of a jump, right? I mean, this is what I think the film shows so dramatically in Grant Township. I mean, Grant Township isn't some sort of like, you know, leftover hippie communist commune, you know, that was decided to survive over the years. I mean, these are just kind of like people living their lives trying to kind of like protect what little they have, right? And then this makes 100% sense to them, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That's one of the most interesting things about the film. One of the things that captures me the most is that you're introducing this concept to a community who would, under any kind of academic circumstances, be thought to reject the idea, right? You wouldn't go and approach this theory in a college and expect people to think that, you know, Grant Township would accept rights of nature and pass it into a law. The same town that voted for Trump both times in the election, you know, not traditionally what you would expect to see as having the most important environmental protections in the state of Pennsylvania. But that, you know, you get to hear from those people directly, rather than hear what you get from the radio buzz and the news buzz and everything else. And you find out that they care about water just as much as the rest of us. And because of that, they understand how important it is, how important it is to protect it. And that becomes, you know, the amalgamation of these environmental issues. They're all able to unify around clean water. And it just sort of takes off from there.
And I think that, you know, what's helped, I think, even bolster this in even a broader public now too, as well, is when we're starting to really draw serious questions about, say, the rights that have been given to corporations. Because, of course, we've handed corporations rights, right? So, and corporations are completely kind of, you know, created and manufactured entities, right? I mean, they're nothing but human creations in order to protect capital in particular circumstances. Whereas the rights of nature, in a sense, has a more direct claim on rights, it would seem to me, than corporations did. And it's all, you know, it's like that one-to-one. Well, if we've done it for corporations and we have a body of law that seems to support this, that we actually protect them under our constitution, for their, doesn't it make sense that we can do this for our ecosystems, which we are actually dependent upon and which we have helped, whether kind of directly or kind of indirectly, help destroy? And so it seems like, you know, finally kind of regaining this partnership with something that, in my mind, seems to have more of a claim on those rights than any corporate entity ever could.
Yeah, I think, well, the corporate entities, you know, they really lost their trust with the people over the last decade dramatically.
Right.
Right. I mean, corporations had a lot more trust, from my perspective, like mid-2000s, than they do anywhere now or the last 10 years. And that has allowed people to get past that first real phase of this, you know, which is, you know, what is a corporation? Should we be granting corporations this power? What about corporate personhood? You know, and getting past that, then they can ask these next questions. Well, what about nature? Should nature also have legal personhood? And if a corporation does, then why couldn't nature? You know, just basic things that you see in the film. And I think that question is so simple and so common sense that it catches like fire, like wildfire,
yep,
across the globe. And because, you know, so few of our countries have any real overwhelming majority of rights of nature recognition, it's just blossoming from state to state and from country to country and from group to group, you know, like we've never seen it before. It's in its, you know, Melissa and I were talking about it. Initially, it was in its infancy when we started the film, but we do feel like it's moving into an adolescent phase, like a new phase of the movement.
Well, and I think it's true too. You know, I'm a Gen Xer, right? I grew up, you know, thinking about nuclear warfare. I think about kind of, you know, like bombs being dropped. I've lived near, you know, grew up in upstate New York, so Griffiths Air Force, yeah, Base was 10 miles away. You know, my friend and I used to sit downstairs and like figure out, like, you know, how long would we take for us to be dead after, you know, Griffiths Air Force Base was that whole Cold War mentality. But of course, as we see with like the Sunrise Movement, we see with Greta Thunberg, we see with a whole new generation of activists, that's just not even in memory, right? So when you start bringing up, you know, we've got a Cold War, don't you know, they're kind of like, okay, boomer, we need to protect the planet, you know. Yeah. And I think that is so refreshing. And I imagine it has to have something to do with the receptiveness too as well, where people are wide open to find ways of kind of new ways of kind of understanding both our place in the world, and not just what our place in the world is now, right, but what it's going to be, right, for several generations down the road. Go ahead. Sorry, go ahead.
I was just gonna say, I mean, you're right. It's the fact that the boomers failed. You know, it's this idea that they have any kind of authority to say what we need to do going forward, and that their plans that they created over the last 50 years are somehow working, and all of them are failing. You know, everything that we got from environmental protections under Richard Nixon's, you know, signing of NEPA back in the 70s and stuff, it's all just failing. It's all a farce. So there needs to be a new way forward, and democracy recognizes that with people voting for this. The economy recognizes that, because it can't get away from having to put nature in the decision-making process, because it's eliminated so much of it and exploited it so badly. And more the recognition of this reality that we need to live within the laws of nature, that we need to give nature personhood, is becoming common sense. And corporations are running scared. So, I mean, they're running scared, trying to pass new bills everywhere right now.
100%. So take us into the kind of film itself here. So when you're doing, I mean, obviously Grant Township, Pennsylvania figures like strongly here, but it's certainly not like the only story. I mean, you know, you take us to, you know, Standing Rock, you're taking us to Bolivia, right? You're taking us to places around the globe. I mean, the stuff around the Great Lakes, I grew up in Utica, New York, spent a lot of time by the Great Lakes and things, to see that the Great Lakes figured into this, you know, into your film too as well. So it seems like that, take us into that. I was like, what do you kind of want to show? What did you want to kind of like lay out for people in this film?
Well, you know, it changed so much when we first started this film from where it is now, from where it initially started. But the one thing that stayed the same was the title, Invisible Hand. And we had that title because we wanted people to remember that one of the main things that need to be talked about here is the economy, is capitalism, the thing that's killing this planet. You know, as much as we want to talk about how great rights of nature is, we also really need to reflect and deconstruct the capitalism and see where we are right now with that. And when we look at something like the Invisible Hand, and we look at Adam Smith's theory from Wealth of Nations about this concept, we can see that it falls apart pretty quickly, that the idea that there's this unseen force kind of controlling the market and balancing the market, allowing you to make profit, allowing I to make profit, and everything to come out for the better at the end and trickle down, isn't real any longer, because we've eliminated the resources for you to make profit, the resources for me to make profit. And that's not the kind of fulcrum, the kind of balancing beam that's going to work in an economy. It's only going to create a monopolization. It's going to destroy the resources you need to make profit, the one I need. And we have to come to terms with the new world. And capitalism is grappling with that through the invisible hand, through the one thing that's supposed to hold it all together. And what's happening is that nature is replacing, you know, this human hand. Nature is becoming the force in the middle, mm-hmm. and the deciding factor on what we're supposed to do. Right. I mean, it's got Elon Musk so scared that he's about to go to Mars. Right. I mean, yep. Nature made that decision for him. It wasn't ours.
Yeah. I've got my Flat Mars Society shirt somewhere too.
Yeah. He can theorize whatever he wants on SNL this weekend, but that guy's freaking out because of what nature's telling him. Nature's making his decisions. Maybe he thinks he's thinking independently, but you know, he's thinking about survival and nature's not going to make it easy for him to survive. So I think that was one of the big things throughout the film. You know, the one guy from the we have these Milton Friedman clips from the 1980s PBS show, Free to Choose, which is one of the books that he published. And he has this like pencil theory in there about, you know, why all these conflicting nations can join together to make a pencil and then you can be writing it and it's all great at the end of the day. Totally disregarding nature and the whole concept and the whole theory, like the entire books that all of them write do. But one of the guys that are inside of the Milton Friedman thing says that, you know, what is at the center of the spaceship making the spaceship run? Right.
Right.
And that's kind of like what we need to get down to the root of is what is making everything run. And we find out that, well, nature's making it all run. You know, that's how everything survives. That's how everything works. It's not Milton Friedman's invisible hand or Adam Smith's invisible hand. You know, it's not Milton Friedman's ideas on the pencil theory. The nature is what brings us all together and balances everything. So that's really important to see throughout the film. And then when we reflect on that and we're trying to find like, well, like who is the voice that, you know, kind of like can teach us about nature and teach us about that world. That's kind of where we're going back into the Haudenosaunee and the Seneca Nation, where Daguerreotypes opens the film with his voice, with his voice attached to nature. And you hear the prophecy and you get to kind of watch their prophecy play out in the film with capitalism, with democracy, with Standing Rock and with the environmental movement. And then like where we are at the end with kind of like nature coming back into the equation and guiding people to their answers. Right. So we have these overarching concepts that come from, you know, the idea of like land recognition, the idea that we're talking about stolen land again, and we're going to try and, you know, give land back. We want to recognize where we are. I am on the Haudenosaunee land up around the Triple Divide right now, you know, mm-hmm. talking to you in the watershed of Oswego Creek, which goes into the Allegheny River, referred to as Ohio by the Seneca Nation. So it's a lot about changing our language and changing the way we speak and think about things. And the film is putting you in that space. And that was most important for us, right? Just to challenge the way you think, challenge the foundation of your ideas. And that's where we wanted the film to go, is to go in that direction. And you see people experience that in the film. And then you get to see it happen in real time. Well, if we challenge that, what are the fights that we're facing? We're facing Standing Rock. We're facing fracking wastewater treatment plants. We're facing radioactive waste storage underground. I mean, the things that they want to do to us is insane. You know, what the corporations want to do to us. So we go in a lot of different places, but you know, the ideas are big. We try and hit really big ideas in the film: democracy, capitalism, rights of nature. You know, things that for us took a long time to thread together.
Yeah, I found those moments where, you know, the prophecy, you know, when the prophecy, the telling of the prophecy comes back, everything slows down too.
Totally.
Which I thought was, you know, I mean, you know, to get into the film itself, right? Just the way that you have these moments of pause and reflection. And I found that to be extraordinarily effective in the film for precisely what you're saying. It's like, you know, part of what we're doing here is it's not just concepts in like, say, Western philosophical thought about concepts, but in terms of narrative and story and how that story is woven into the very ways that we kind of act in the world. And I thought that with, you know, that coupled with, you know, the, you know, pencil theory from Milton Friedman just shows you in a sense how fabricated that story is. right? Yeah. On his part. But then it gives us this space, right, as a viewer, at least I certainly felt this, right, gave me the space as a viewer to pause and kind of let that narrative sink in. Let that prophecy sink in as kind of like, what does this actually really mean? And I thought that was very effective and let it unfold over the course of the film instead of saying, okay, now in this segment, we're going to go hear about this prophecy, right? Mm-hmm. But we're asked to actually grapple with that narrative in a way that was felt, say, inclusive, right? And saying, this is a story for all of us, right? This is not kind of just going to import this, but we want to spend time here, right? And think about what this means in going forward.
Yeah, and that reflection, you know, that also has a lot to do with, like, you know, getting away from yourself, you know, getting away from your ego and your self-interest, because that's what capitalism is doing, and that's what a lot of the environmental movement is doing, is they're constantly, like, demanding this from your self-interest and demanding that and making you think about, you know, you and what's best for you and what's best for humans, right? And then you have this like completely different concept, which is saying, you know, if nature is at the center of decision making, this is the way we're thinking. You know, we're thinking in a totally different realm, in a totally different space, totally different sound. You know, the whole world's different once you shift from putting, you know, creating an anthropocentric society where humans are at the middle to an ecocentric society where we're putting nature at the middle. And that's, for me, like, that's that breath of fresh air, right? It's like, whoa, finally, I can, like, step out of myself for a minute and experience, you know, this tremendous, powerful relationship that I haven't been able to experience enough, which is what it's like to be, you know, in this phenomenon of nature and all of its magic. And we try and just convey that in the film.
I mean, certainly think it comes through. And it, I mean, it seems that this is something that has come through, you know, everywhere you go, it seems. I mean, the film is, you know, been recognized by what? I mean, I don't know what the full count is, but clearly over a dozen, perhaps more, of awards that you guys have won for the film. I mean, what has that been reception has been like? Because, I mean, as people are watching this film and it's kind of, you know, winning these awards, what kind of feedback have you been getting even from that community?
I think it's been a lot of different reactions. You know, most recently we had a conversation with people who are in touch with, like, you know, Netflix and HBO, and one of their reactions was, I cannot believe, you know, the EPA is doing this and the DEP is doing this. So, you know, it's them having that shock, which is realizing the complete annihilation of the public trust, right? You know, there's public trust has been built around these agencies for decades, and so many people do still believe in it. But when you're like us and you're investigative journalists and you've spent 10 years looking at what they do,
disabuses, you know, you find, of that disposition.
I know.
It's like, oh no, sorry.
It is a scam.
Yeah.
It is one of the greatest scams that have been marketed on the American society since its inception, and it's been done, you know, for corporations to exploit the environment. So, you know, we have that reaction, and then we get the reaction from the Rights of Nature movement, which was one that we were most concerned about, and theirs has been just so uplifting and overwhelming because they see it kind of like we see it, which is, you know, this story that we thought would be kind of introducing rights of nature and then, like, these darker sides of the world, but instead it's this introducing rights of nature and seeing, like, all the hope that's there at the end, you know, like all the possible, like, wins and successes that can happen if you step out of this traditional environmental box, you know, and you move into a different realm where you want to give nature personhood. And you see these wins in the film and you're like, and it's just astonishing, right? For us to see it. We didn't think that was going to happen,
yep.
You know, after 6 years, we're so used to seeing losses. So I think everybody's kind of been, you know, really excited about that part of it. And just having the opportunity to say, well, here's what I think Rights of Nature is, but go watch Invisible Hand and tell me what you think.
Right.
You know, and that's been really powerful for people, giving them that option to have a film where they can send people to, just like you and I would do with a book, you know, or a film, sure, or any other subject. There's just never been a film out there for Rights of Nature to attach itself to in this way. So now we're just starting, you know, down that path. We can see where we're going to go from here.
Well, you know, it's funny. I mean, you talk about this at a lot of, you know, social movement theory and things too, as well. It's like, you know, once you get to this point of being able to have cultural productions, of being able to bring all this stuff together, it becomes so important to actually, you know, say democratize, you know, these concepts. Because, you know, initially there's, you know, we don't have a culture where, you know, as much as we want to talk about democracy and deliberation and free exchange of ideas, there's very few places on, like, in this nation, for, or the planet for that matter, but really in particular in this country, where, you know, we have the opportunity for these kind of these discussions to take place. And so when you see something come together culturally, it's able to have an impact, I think, at least, that, you know, all the reporting, you know, and I know that you've done a ton of it, right? All the investigative work and all the reporting doesn't have that same reach, right? Where it allows us to, you know, just to, you know, I remember this, somebody talking about comedy once as kind of, you know, comedy is the back door to your brain, right? So that if you want to introduce kind of, you know, political concepts or things like this, comedy is very often a way, because it gets around those defense mechanisms that are already bet up, or there's, even if you want to talk about as the, you know, the ways that we're used to thinking and the barriers that are put up when we were kind of confronted with something different, right? Those cognitive frames or whatever you want to call them. And so to see it, you know, this film where it offers, and I also think, well, I was thinking a lot about this after I watched the film the second time, because I just wanted to watch it again because it was just so good. And my wife has promised me, I keep on telling her about the film. She's like, when are we going to watch it? I'm like, okay, yes, we're going to do it again. But I think that, you know, one of the things I was thinking a lot about was, that when I think we've been all inundated with so much disaster, whether, you know, especially now in the amidst the pandemic, but it's not because of the pandemic. I think the pandemic only has kind of, I don't know, sharpened the edges of disaster. I mean, we've had a, you know, an economic collapse. We see kind of all of the climate crisis is in our face every single day. We see, you know, the destruction and the, you know, the open kind of, you know, racist policing and the assassination to, you know, of African Americans in the street to protect white supremacy. We see this kind of stuff all the time. And so in some ways I kept on thinking about this film instead of the issues of, I mean, because look, I mean, you got some pretty serious issues at the core of the film, right? Is our planet going to survive, and is civilization have hope? I mean, really, I mean, that's the baseline, right? And yep. I think that because people have been immersed in that feeling, right, that feeling of, say, of despair, destruction, and anger, that instead of that, you know, those questions being devastating ones, they're actually like acknowledgement, right? Yes, these things are real, and I feel it too. So there was this moment I felt, at least, of kind of like being together in the film, right? Mm-hmm. And then being able to take us in a different direction where we saw glimmers of hope, you know? Right. And I that's kind of really the way, if I had to talk about my, and this is, I've been fumbling with ways of putting that into words in multiple conversations that I've had with people at the film, but that's the kind of the way I keep on trying to frame what I walk away with, right? Because when I tell people, look, you know, we talk about climate change, they're like, oh God, another disaster film. I'm like, no. It's not that, right? This is not going to go, you're going to see there, you're going to feel like you have to lock yourself in a closet for a week. It's like, this is like so beautiful and hopeful despite that. So, you know, again, this goes back to the thank you, so because that's really what I felt was at the core of it, and it was able to bring it to, I don't know, such fruition in such a hopeful manner. So,
well, we need to thank those people who did what they did.
Totally.
The people 100%. At Standing Rock, you know, who shared their story and fought that fight and are still fighting that fight there. The people in Toledo, Ohio, you know, Marky and Tish from CellDef, who are still fighting for that lake. And the stories that they share, Stacy Long and her mother Judy. You know, Judy Juan Chisholm is Stacy's mom in the film, and she's just an amazing defender of Mother Earth. You know, kind of just coming out of nowhere and just creating this whole culture for Rights of Nature in Grant Township by knocking on doors and doing everything that they did. JP stepping up and getting elected in Grant Township as supervisor, and Stacy doing as well. JP's partner, Billy. Billy becoming, you know, one of the people who helped coordinate and network and communicate with everybody in the community. I mean, you begin to like live this life with them, and you relate so much to their struggle, you know, that you do feel part of them. In the film, I remember I was like tearing up every time I had to do Stacy's part at the end, where she was like crying about, you know, how thankful she was that everybody was there for them in court, you know, and they all stood outside of the court afterwards. And it was just a powerful moment to kind of even watching it, like, you know, 30 times, it still would get me.
Yeah.
And then just to, you know, just to come back to like the core of that, and the core of that being, you know, our connection to nature, and that being best represented through civilizations like the Seneca Nation of Indians or the Haudenosaunee Prophecy. You know, I mean, they're the ones to turn to for these answers. And to have them, you know, at the end of the film to help kind of like guide us down that road. Yeah, like that's, we were really happy with what happened there. So I hope people get it. I hope people who are watching get to go see it, because there's just, especially if you're in PA, there's so many shots from Pennsylvania.
Oh my God, yeah.
Yeah, well, there's a ton of footage from PA.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, you can check out, everybody, you can check out this film. You can check out all the information about it. You go to InvisibleHandFilm.com. You go to InvisibleHandFilm.com. You can rent it. You can buy it, as I did. Yeah. You can become, I want to talk about Public Herald in a second, but you can become a patron of Public Herald and kind of all the work that they're doing kind of over there. But please do, seriously, I'm definitely make sure that you see this. And you know, I've been saying that hopefully if we're, you know, I'm back on campus at Kutztown University in the fall, I'm going to be searching out folks. I know I've got a good community of folks. See if we can kind of put together a kind of some showings and some showing of the films that we can make sure that right here and say, you know, right in this area and everywhere across Pennsylvania, for that matter, gets to see this film, because it's absolutely critical. So to remind you, you can actually support this show right now. You can become a patron for as little as $5 a month. Go to patreon.com/RC Press. Make sure if you're watching us on YouTube right now, make sure you hit that subscribe button. Make sure you like this stream and make sure you hit that little bell to remind you every time that we go live. The more that we can broadcast out and give a signal boost to everyone that we have on this program, the better. And if you got any kind of, we're running up on, we're getting kind of close to time here. So if anybody does have any questions or any kind of comments you want to throw in the YouTube chat, please let me know and I'll relay them and we'll bring it up here. Let me ask you this I don't want to feel like we're kind of turning a corner, like a 90 degree angle. It's like, okay, now let's talk about this. But I think that, you know, it kind of goes to was talking about, say, these, you know, culture productions, this film and stuff. But I do want to kind of give a shout out and a little space here to what you're doing at Public Herald. I mean, I think the role, you know, of, say, investigative kind of independent media that's doing this kind of work, number one, it's a struggle to find people who are able to sustain that work. So to see what you're doing at Public Herald and to see the kind of work that you've been able to do over time is just astonishing. You know, to see these films kind of come out of that space too as well is pretty remarkable. So can you talk a little bit about, say, Public Herald and kind of like what you're doing with that space, right? And how you're even freaking surviving at this point.
First rule at Public Herald is we don't talk about Public Herald. So, Melissa and I started Public Herald in almost 10 years ago in Potter County, Pennsylvania, to deal with the fracking industry. It was, you know, I had come here looking at the situation, realizing how dangerous it was. I had a background with an environmental firm, so I understood soil testing, water testing, brownfield, Superfund site remediation, you know, how to do a lab analysis and review those results, how to find the records, right? That's really what it boils down to. And that's what Public Herald became. We became like your worst nightmare for record collection. We spent more time in DEP's offices collecting records than we probably did sleeping in our own homes in some cases. We started to dive deep, hard and fast. Melissa and I did, with a team of amazing people. You can find them on publicherald.org. I think slash about slash team, everybody who's kind of helped out in the past. And we've just been building it more and more project to project. We usually work, you know, project based, and we keep funding that way. We have funding from quite a few public members. Patreon has been a recent revenue of support for ways that people can kind of sustain funding to our work on a monthly basis and get rewards for it, you know, get things back. We just created these awesome Defend Nature's Rights stickers that Meg Lemire did, who also did Waterways, a really good poster. And those are available through Patreon. So you go to patreon.com/publicherald and you can join us through one of the tiers for $1 or $5 or something and get access to those. And foundations have been there for us in the past. I mean, we are, you know, we're an edgy organization. You know, we're stepping on a lot of toes.
Well, and that's exactly why I you know, I wanted to give you that spot, this in particular, a little light on this, because I mean, you're not one of these like investigative groups that is like, okay, we're doing this independent reporting and, you know, we're going to look at both sides. I mean, this is like serious muckraking work that y'all are doing.
Well, we do believe the look at both sides independent stuff is bullshit. so we're not even going to pretend that that's a reality. This idea of balanced journalism that has been that the public relations industry has infected into journalism has been another tremendous success of capitalism and where we are. I don't know if that goes back to Bernays' book on propaganda or not, but public relations has done an extremely fantastic job of destroying journalism by creating this idea of false equivalence and balance. It's not real. You don't have a story with primary sources and then all of a sudden introduce sources that have no relationship to that story in order to create a balance there, because the ending of that story is negative, right? And that's what happens with NPR all the time.
Right.
I mean, State Impact PA over and over again, everything they publish has to be balanced this way. If you read the, you know, the last quotes in their stories, it's oftentimes from an industry person. Same thing with Post-Gazette. Post-Gazette fell apart. You know, we can't get them to do any kind of hardcore reporting without soft shoeing it. You know, we tipped them off about the Attorney General thing and they wouldn't write about it for a year. It took them a year to actually publish about the Attorney General thing after we spoke to them about it, because the, you know, they didn't want to work together. They didn't want to have a relationship. And that's what we're dealing with. We're dealing with, you know, a journalism industry that is afraid of creating hard hitting reporting. And there's problems with, you know, conservative editorial boards. There's problems with funding controlling too much of that voice. And there's, of course, this problem, this PR problem of balance. And then the other really big issue is that, you know, these good journalists who are doing some of the best work keep getting pushed out of the places that they're in. I mean, Glenn Greenwald, people can say what they want about him, but he's a fantastic journalist. He's done fantastic work. He should have left The Intercept. Now he's one of the founding members there. And the fact that guy's gone is only going to hurt that organization. You know, he should have been there the whole time. Or Laura Petraeus. You know, Laura Petraeus also founded that and she's gone, you know. And I feel like that just, you know, that for The Intercept not to create space for those kinds of people, you know, it just, that sucks. Because we would want to be working with a group like that, right?
Right.
But now it's like, I don't know, man. You know, you're not really hitting the right buttons there. So
it's tough, you know, because I think about it like this too. Is like, I've always thought about like a good journalism outlet is one that is extraordinarily messy, right? And like,
yeah, I think that's hard. That's one of the hardest parts. It is messy.
Yeah,
we just had a conversation today about that. You know, the fact that we can't meet deadlines because our stories are always on floating deadlines. And we're always dealing with new variables. It's just one new variable after the next, you know? And then somebody said, I don't know, we were in a conversation last week about this, about a new story. And they said, you know, will State Impact cover it? You know, and I'm thinking, no, man, they're not going to cover it. You know, and that's just like, for some reason, folks still think like, you know, like NPR covering a story makes that story a success. And that's not true. I mean, we've proven that over and over again, which is that we're doing this alone as an independent company. We have readers from all over the world, and part of that is because of how hard hitting we are, how fact-based we are, how much the time that we put into these stories. I mean, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, and the distribution. I mean, our distribution is not like other organizations. We're running Google ads. We're using all the things that corporations use to sell you their products. We're using that to try and sell the stories, you know?
Yeah.
Google ads, social media ads, everything. And luckily I've got a big background in that. So I know how to distribute it. So that stuff puts us into these spaces. Like Southwestern Pennsylvania might never get to read about radioactivity and fracking until we start putting ads of our articles all over their Facebook right. channels, all over their phones, you know, and that kind of thing. So that's been one of the ways that we've been successfully able to keep momentum going at Public Herald and keep our readership up, is to have just a distribution model that's totally different from most people.
Man, I'm loving it. I'll tell you that. It's and congratulations on like continuing to put out that stuff. Let me ask, we got a question here from Nick. I don't know if this is kind of when you're wrong. What are your thoughts on the Red New Deal?
Sorry, what's that?
What are your thoughts on the Red New Deal? I'm not familiar with it, to be honest with you. So
I'm not familiar with it either. I think that has to do with the idea of land back, but I'm not totally sure. Just let me double check. Because I remember hearing something about that, and I think that it immediately got flagged as communism, but of course it's not.
It's got the color red in the title.
Yeah, it has to do with the idea of Native Americans taking control over the voice of something like the Green New Deal.
Gotcha.
And implementing, you know, their ideas into it. So I think that's necessary. I feel like the Green New Deal is not strong enough at all right now. It's just a kind of capitalism 2.0. which isn't going to do much for us. We need something a hell of a lot stronger than that at this point. You know, if we want to talk about climate change, that's one thing. But if we look at the collapse of ecosystems and the eco side that's happening, you know, hopefully something like the Red New Deal would include nature, eco side, rights of nature throughout that whole thing, right? I mean, nature, when we scanned the Green New Deal, I think nature had appeared one time in the entire language, the word nature. So yeah, we need something different. So red deal, definitely.
Excellent. And Nick says that he said it hasn't dug in too far himself yet, but he did hear it on Democracy Now. So we'll see if we can do it. We can pull up a link of that too as well. And Brian's putting a link to an article in there from Teen Vogue on it too as well. So yeah. This is cool. We'll definitely dig into that a little bit. And sounds like I have got some potential guests for some future shows coming up as we put that in. Well, listen, I know we're running up on time. I know your time is valuable and I want to keep it too long, but you know, thank you so much for coming on tonight. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it and how much, just even personally, this film is meant for me. It's, you know, I think coming, you know, I'll put it like this, is, you know, in the midst of a pandemic, which I've been kind of like wedded to my computer, teaching classes kind of like online. My two kids are kind of juggling what online schooling and hybrid schooling to try to get through all this stuff. And then watch the sheer past 4 years of an absolute shit show, right? And then having to deal with the celebrations that we've got rid of Trump and everything's fine now, you know, to have this film come along and say, no, kind of like remind you, no, everybody out there has been pointing to this stuff for saying this was not just about Trump. This was not just about kind of a nice little fix that we need, but we really need something substantial. And this film really kind of came along at the right time. And I can't tell you, everybody get out there and make sure that you check out invisiblehandfilm.com. Make sure you kind of give some love over publicherald.org. You know, and anything else you want to leave everybody with tonight, Josh?
Oh, no, I think you did just a great job of sharing all these important points in the film. And, you know, I think that if folks can just be mindful of putting nature, you know, at the center of your decision making, kind of removing yourself, I feel like that's one of the most important things, and making sure that, you know, you're recognizing nature in every way possible. Going forward, if you can, you know, every day there's a chance to defend nature's rights. So go for it.
100%. Well, again, thank you so much for kind of taking time out tonight. I appreciate it so much. Appreciate the film. Everybody, once again, head on over and make sure that you check out kind of invisiblehandfilm.com, and you will not be sorry, and share it with every single person that you know. Have viewing parties with, as long as you get the correct license for it, make sure. Tell your local libraries. If you're affiliated with an academic institution, make sure it's ordered in that institution. Put in your order, because this film is potentially that big, and appreciate time. So Joshua, thanks again for your time. And man, I'm looking forward to everything that you're putting out in a Public Herald, and I'll be watching your film once again this week with my wife. So
thanks again, Kevin, for that. So glad to be here, man.
Oh man, this is fantastic. All right, this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. Want to remind you once again that you can help support the show by going to patreon.com/rcpress, become a patron for as little as $5 a month, and make sure you kind of like subscribe to this channel, make sure you like this show, and make sure you hit that little bell so you know every time we go live. We'll talk to you all soon. See ya!